Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Gilchrist Museum is well known for the depth and breadth of its collections in art, documents, ethnic collections, but their latest exhibit focuses on a lesser-known archaeological collection, but just as significant, from a people that we know very little about. West Mexico, Ritual and Identity is a new exhibit featuring objects Thomas Gilchrist collected in the late 40s and 50s from the area around Guadalajara to the Pacific Coast. This ancient culture flourished from 300 BC to 500 AD. Today, we know them best as the shaft tomb culture for their funerary sites from where most of the exhibit's ceramic objects came. But the exhibit is more than a collection of stunning 2,000-year-old ceramic objects and vessels. It also details the search to better understand this culture and the people who live there. Robert Pickering is the curator of the exhibit and professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa. He's worked on and off in the West Mexican culture for over 30 years. West Mexico, Ritual and Identity is on display through November 6th. Bob, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
And I know this exhibit is near and dear to your heart. You've been working on this West Mexican culture for many years before you came to Tulsa. I mean, nearly your entire academic career, you've been looking at this area that is now on display at Gilchrist.
You know, I think some of us in the academic field, and in archaeology particularly, become enamored with some of the areas where we do our first field work. And for me, I was sort of doubly blessed to do some field work in Illinois, where I grew up, but also in North and West Mexico. I started working there as part of an archaeology project when I was an undergraduate at SIU Carbondale back in the 1970s. As you know, that was right after the Spanish Revolution, I think. So I've been working there for a long time and have become really fascinated by the archaeology, by the ethnology, by the people, by just the entire place. It's just magical.
And this is a culture we know very little about. I mean, we're learning more about, but really, as far as any written accounts of this culture, there are none.
Well, you bring up a really good point, because trying to do an exhibit of this material, it's for the public. What does the public know? I mean, I'm a believer in the sort of the how you put together an exhibit. You start with where people are, not where you want them to be. You want to make connections. And truth be told, very little is known about this. And doing an exhibit like this really shines the uncomfortable spotlight on how much we don't know, as opposed to what we do know. Now, there are certainly things we know, and we know more now than we did, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. But it's an incomplete story at best. But that's kind of why we do this in the first place, is to fill in the blanks, to help people understand who these amazing people were who lived between Guadalajara and the west coast of Mexico approximately 2,000 years ago.
So this culture predates the Aztecs.
1,500 years earlier than the Aztecs. They're not the Maya. Of course, the Maya still live in southern Mesoamerica, southern Mexico. But yeah, they predate the cultures you think you know in Mexico, the Aztecs, the Maya, the Toltecs. Now, having said that, this culture is semi-contemporaneous with Teotihuacan, which is the mega site in Mexico. And there's some evidence that there may have been contact or trade between the two, but they are definitely not the same culture.
And so this comes from the Gilchrist collection, and this is really an exhibit that shows off the sort of the breadth of the collection. It's something that you don't normally see at the museum, maybe a figure or two, and this show really sort of showcases what became really a major passion for Thomas Gilchrist towards the end of his life, when he was sponsoring digs and buying as much as he could from this West Mexican culture. He was in early on this.
Absolutely. I have to say, you know, I've been here in Tulsa now for 7 years, and there have been some wonderful surprises. And one of the surprises was this West Mexican collection. I mean, you know, in the art world, the Gilchrist art collection, American art collection, is legendary. I mean, there's no question about that. In the Midwestern archaeology world, which is a much smaller world perhaps, Thomas Gilchrist's Midwestern archaeology collection is equally legendary to the art collection. What I didn't know when I came here is that he also collected Mexican, Central American, South American material. Between about 1948 and 1955, he collected over 400 figures and ceramic pieces from West Mexico. It's not the largest collection in the U.S., but it is a large collection. And because it was put together relatively early in the 1940s and 50s, there are some spectacular things in the collection, and some have been on display, some have been loaned for other exhibits, but certainly this is the largest presentation of the Gilcrease West Mexican collection that's ever been done.
Now, for the specialists who specialize in these cultures along the west coast of Mexico, is this like a revelation that the museum has this many pieces and so many really fine pieces?
It will be, yes. which is one of the reasons, you know, what's the purpose of doing an exhibit in a museum? Why do we do all this? Well, it's to demonstrate the importance of these collections and the people who made them. And I think for archaeology, that's particularly important. As an anthropologist, part of what I try to do in an exhibit is to help bring the people alive for a modern audience. I try to help make connections and try to encourage visitors to see these people as people, not as sort of these abstract entities from the past. I just don't find that very interesting. So what we try to do in this exhibit, and West Mexico is very well suited for this, there's lots of information in the ceramic and artifact material that tells stories. When you look at these amazing ceramic figures, and they are, I believe, truly amazing, there are lots of hollow ceramic figures of people, of animals, of plants, food plants. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even more important, there are small scenes or tableaus that show actual activities and rituals that went on at the time. There aren't very many cultures, ancient cultures around the world where you find that. We have a small display of Han Dynasty Chinese material from basically the same time period, about 2,000 years ago, showing that the Chinese also created temple models, images of people, warriors and other people, and dogs. Well, you find all those in West Mexico. I'm not suggesting that West Mexico and China are related. It's just that they, too, were creating these sort of monumental ceramic figures to be preserved and to represent their way of life.
Were these mostly funerary? Yeah, funerary objects.
Yeah.
This is sort of gives us the name of the culture in many ways, and I think you have some problems with it. It's called the Shaft Tomb culture.
It's unfortunate that the early recognition of West Mexico, because there's not in West Mexico, you don't find the monumental stone above ground architecture that you think of when you think of Palenque or Chichen Itza or Teotihuacan. In West Mexico, yes, there is above ground architecture, but it was stone, dirt, and adobe. It didn't last as well. It wasn't as impressive. What campesinos, farmers, mm-hmm. found in the 19th century is that sometimes if they found a tomb, which they would dig, they found these wonderful ceramic figures and they could sell them. So from a very early date, the shaft tomb figures became sort of the emblem, if you will, of ancient West Mexico. Now, what's been sort of intriguing by some, related to some of the research that we've done for this exhibit, is that we're able to demonstrate that, one, there's use wear on some of the figures and some of the vessels that came from the shaft tombs, which means they were not made for the shaft tomb. They probably were used in rituals above ground and then were deposited in the tombs with the human remains. From colleagues who are working in the field, both Mexican and American archaeology colleagues, we know that some of these figures, in fact, don't come from shaft tombs. They come from the living sites. Mm. So we're re-examining this whole idea of where do these figures come from, and that gets to what do they mean.
Well, and you know, you were talking about how there are figures, there are ceramic representations of dogs and animals, and of plant material that you would eat. That would almost suggest like Egyptian culture. You know, you take all your things when you're going to the afterlife, so you'll have them. Is it the same sort of thing, do you think?
It is. I mean, again, the sad news is in West Mexico, probably 99.9% of the shaft tombs have been looted rather than excavated by archaeologists. So we don't know a lot of context that we would like. But from the ones that have been excavated by archaeologists, we know that, yes, there were large numbers of vessels that were placed in the tombs. And, of course, being good archaeologists, you know, we're very interested in form and what's the style name for this.
And where was it located?
And where was it located, yeah. Which is all very important. Yeah. Uh-huh. But one of the things that we're also doing in research, and we've been doing this now at the Gilcrease for just about a year, is doing what's called residue analysis. We're working with a lab that essentially extracts some of the residue from inside these vessels. I mean, wouldn't it be interesting to know what these vessels contained rather than just what they looked like? So one of the most interesting pieces so far is on a small number of vessels from the Gilcrease West Mexico collection, we have found residue related to datura.
Datura.
A hallucinogenic plant. And you find datura used really all over Mesoamerica, probably into the American Southeast and even the Southwest. So we're finding it in West Mexican vessels. We're finding it in at least two types of vessels. One is called a mocajete, and it's a little tripod vessel that has cross-hatching on the inside. And another term for it is a chili grinder or spice grinder. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's probably the vessel they were using to make this drink out of datura. And then a couple of the other vessels may indeed be the drinking vessels.
Do we think it was a ritual, part of worship?
A ritual drink.
Drink to send you to another state?
Yeah, when we say ritual,
peyote?
That normally means we don't really know for sure. But yes, it probably was involved in ritual, but what kind of ritual, what purpose, we don't know those things. But it leads us in a direction that we can start now asking some more sophisticated questions.
Now, you mentioned that there were above ground remains of this mm-hmm. culture. What do we know about how this culture lived? We have to remember it's about 300 BC
Absolutely.
To 500
yeah.
AD. By comparison, the Anasazis in southwestern the United States is what, about 800?
About that. Hopewell, 1300. Middle Woodland, east of the Mississippi, you know, that's roughly the same time period, a couple of hundred BC to a couple of hundred AD.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a time in which people were hunting and gathering. They were fishing. One of the great things about West Mexico from an ecological standpoint is it's a rich and diverse environment. It has a great climate. It has everything from active volcanoes, the Colima volcano, for example, to other mountains, to beaches, to large inland lakes. And then, of course, you have the entire Pacific coast. And what we see is that people were utilizing resources, not just food resources, but mineral and natural resources from all of those environmental areas. But they were also agriculturalists. They were farmers. Now, normally, when we think of agriculture, we see that as a mark of high culture, of great achievement. Anthropologists kind of don't necessarily share that idea. Agriculture is a response to a growing human population that's not able to feed itself by hunting and gathering.
Yeah, you have to cultivate
crops to
feed everybody.
And the good news about agriculture is it may give you a more consistent and reliable diet. The bad news about agriculture is that it's not necessarily as healthy a diet. You know, my background is in human osteology, paleopathology, and one of the hallmarks of agricultural cultures is that they tend to have much worse dental health than their hunting and gathering counterparts, and they also are more likely to have other kinds of nutritional deficiency diseases. And we from the few skeletons that have been analyzed from West Mexico, you do get that kind of picture.
That was the next question. Do we have human remains to give us a sense of who these people were and how they lived their lives?
Well,
or were they not well preserved?
Funny you should ask. Certainly, because of all the looting in West Mexico, those remains have been destroyed, sadly. In the 1990s, when I was at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, that was my most active period of field work in West Mexico. And I worked with different groups of Mexican archaeological colleagues to analyze the human remains from their excavations. The most significant of those was the Huitzilapa tomb, which was truly spectacular. It had a shaft of over 9 meters in depth. It had two tomb chambers at the bottom, three individuals in each of the two rooms. It had extraordinary artifact materials and these figures. In fact, it was because I was in West Mexico working on the skeletons that I became intrigued by the human figures. It was clear that the remains had clusters of these hollow ceramic figures with the remains. And I'd seen them before, but I didn't know what they were. And I was intrigued by, are these representing the same people? Does this group of female figures—
Is that your family?
No. Or we'll get to what I think these are. Okay. But clearly there were female figures with female human remains, male figures with male human remains.
So they were segregated
segregated. And so to make a long story short, my current hypothesis for what these represent is that they may be representations of achieved statuses in life. You know, if you want to tell people who you are, these figures say you have accomplished this. You are a leader, you are a chief, you are a warrior, a ball player, you've had children, you've done these things.
Or when you were young, you came of age, you passed whatever ritual it was of manhood or womanhood.
So that's sort of the hypothesis. Now, the downside of that is, in order to test that, you really need to have as many samples as you can in context so you can actually draw comparisons and similarities. That may not be possible in the 21st century. So much looting has gone on that there may not be that many pristine shaft tombs out there. But it really means we need to mine the data of past excavations to collect as much information as we can, because it's kind of significant in terms of what do these figures mean.
Now, you mentioned that these shafts are, 9 meters deep?
Well, it depends. There are some that are as shallow as 2 or 3 meters in depth. There are some that are 19 meters in depth.
So we're talking 50, 60 feet.
Yes. Now, this gets into the architecture thing.
Were these constructed shafts or naturally occurring? Or?
Well, when you think of architecture, we think of what I call above-ground architecture. And if you pile a lot of rocks and a lot of dirt in one place, people go, wow, isn't that impressive? You know, it's a temple, it's a pyramid, it's a whatever it happens to be, but it's above ground and you can see it from a distance. And gee, these must have been spectacular engineers because look what they did. Well, shaft tombs are below ground architecture. You don't see them. But they were planned, they were excavated, they were dangerous. And those that go down 19 meters... some of these have not just one chamber at the bottom. They may have 2, 3, and at least one case, 4 chambers. If you took all the dirt and rock from a shaft tomb and piled it above ground, you'd say, gee, aren't these people amazing? Look what they were able to do. So I see this as a very sophisticated piece of architecture. But to get to your earlier point, yes, there is some very impressive above-ground architecture. There's an extraordinary site called Guachimontón, and it has it's been mapped. It's been partially reconstructed. We actually have some 360 video in the exhibit so that you can look at the site all around. It has huge, or at least one huge, circular stepped platform pyramid. Now, what does that mean? If you look at Aztec or even Teotihuacan architecture, it's rectangular, it's platformed so that the base is larger than the section that comes above it, and it's a platform pyramid. I mean, anybody who knows Mexican archaeology, you sort of get that picture. Mm-hmm. Well, so in a sense, the West Mexican architecture is similar, except it's round rather than square. Now, what does that mean?
So is it more of an obelisk in a way?
It's a cone.
A cone, okay.
It's a stepped cone. Now, in addition to that, around these stepped cone, let's call them stepped cone pyramids, there is a circular plaza. So this is probably where ritual activity went on. Around the circular plaza, there are raised banquettes or structures on which temples and houses were built. So you have a circular urban pattern rather than a square urban pattern. You also have, at Guachimontón and other West Mexican sites, you have the West Mexican ball game, because we know there, we found ball court architecture at the sites, and as you will see in the exhibit, there's actually a ceramic model of the Mesoamerican ball game. So this is as close as anybody gets to sort of a snapshot of behavior in the past.
Yeah. Now, did they live in, I've heard they've lived in sort of apartment structures?
That's a little more complicated. There's been so little excavation.
And when I hear that, I think of Pueblo culture,
not like that at all. Mm-hmm. No. What you do get in West Mexico, which is intriguing, is, okay, so we've just talked about that the architectural pattern is circular with a temple in the middle, plaza, the raised houses or structures. What you find is that they are linked. So a small agricultural site may have one circle. A big site like Guachimontón has over half a dozen of these circles, plus ball courts, plus other kinds of architecture. So what do these circles mean? Does that mean that as the population grew, it sort of budded off into a new circle? That could be. Could it be that each of these circles represents a clan or a lineage? Yeah, that could be too. So we know what the physical structure looks like. But again, trying to determine meaning on that is a little more difficult.
Yeah, but isn't it interesting, though, that, you know, when you think of European cultures, we're like geometry, you know, the square, you know, even the East Mexican cultures that you're talking about earlier, it's square. And in this culture, it's all about the circle.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, and there has certainly been some research and writing in the anthropological literature about what's the deal between square and circular architecture. You know, circular on a much smaller scale, if you're in a circular structure, it's usually fire and hearth-centered, and activities go on around that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you may not spend much time in that structure. You may be doing most of your activities outside that structure. When you start getting square architecture, one of the suggestions is people can store things, can put things away. There are corners to stick things in. So that the activity that goes on in a round structure rather than a square structure are or can be very different. Now, do we know what that means in West Mexico? I really don't. But it's very intriguing because there are many things in West Mexico that are very, very similar to the Valley of Mexico and to Teotihuacan. But there are some things that are totally different. So you ask the question, what's the nature of the difference? Why have they done it their way rather than some other way?
And we just don't know.
And we don't know that. So that's kind of what keeps us all interested and in the business.
My guest today is Bob Pickering, a professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa. He's a curator at Gilcrease, working on their anthropological and archaeological collections, and he's a curator for West Mexico Ritual and Identity. It's on display through November 6th. This is another great area of collecting that Mr. Gilcrease did over the years. What got him interested in archaeology and in archaeology in this particular place? Was it just the fact that he was sort of early and he could get these great examples like the ones on the cover of the catalog, which are like 30 inches high? These amazing pieces.
If I had a time machine.
You'd like to know.
I mean, the more time I spend at the Gilcrease, the more impressed I am by Thomas Gilcrease and his insights. I do believe that because of his Native American heritage, his mother was Muscogee Creek, I do believe that he wanted people to see Indian art as fully developed world-class art.
So he's helping people like Willard Stone and
exactly.
A.C. Blue Eagle, but he's also going back and looking at cultures that long gone hundreds and thousands of years ago.
I think they're part and
parcel
of the same thing. He wanted to support contemporary Indian artists, but he also wanted people to appreciate the art of the past. He wanted, and this he collected broadly over North America, though interestingly, at the time he was collecting, there were big collections put together in the American Southwest, the so-called Anasazi mm-hmm. tradition and all that. He has some of that, but clearly that was not his focus. He was interested in the American Midwest and the Southeast. So his archaeology collections are extraordinary for what he put together. In fact, at one point he hired Greg Perino, who I knew in his older years and when I was a graduate student at Northwestern. He hired Greg Perino to go excavate archaeological sites and bring the objects back to the Gilcrease. Mr. Gilcrease understood, and again, this shows how perceptions and life changes as time goes on. He recognized that some of the best things, the prettiest objects, were found in burial contexts. Hmm. So he had Greg excavate burial mounds and things. Well, today, we look at that in a very different way.
True.
You know, does that make Thomas Gilchrist a bad guy? No, it makes him a man of his time. And his purpose was not to dishonor the people of the past. In fact, it was totally the opposite. It was to honor the people of the past and to say, look at the great things that they have done.
It sounds like this is a twofold exhibit, one that shows what the Gilchrist Collection has and also sort of the state of research into this culture that it really doesn't have a good name for it because we don't know what they called themselves.
Well, it's threefold, but let's stick with twofold for right now. I mean, you know, I've been a museum guy for my whole career, but I've also been an anthropologist and a scientist. I do this because it's really fun. Science is fun. Trying to answer questions to which you have no answers yet is really fun. And I think in this, in this exhibit, there's a section that demonstrates the science of how we know. So we talk about using endoscopy, an endoscope, to look inside these hollow figurines. And you know, what does that tell us? We use X-ray and CAT scan to examine these figures inside and out. We do residue analysis. We've done some DNA analysis on insect remains that we have found in some of these vessels. So I think the second part of the story is how do we know these things we're saying? I mean, we don't make this up. We have some evidence for what we do. And that, to me, is the exciting part. I have to say also, for me, starting in the 1990s, one of the reasons I started working on these figures was to answer two museum questions. What's the value of archaeological collections in museums? And what do those collections tell us about the people and the culture from which they come? The first question is important in light of NAGPRA and the issues of appropriation of right. other cultural mm-hmm. material. It's important. So, you know, I think we, as museum people, need to have a reason for why we have these collections and what we do with them. If their only value is aesthetic, they're pretty.
Right. They should be back in the tomb.
That doesn't do it for me. On the other hand, to make old collections new again is to use new research and new ideas to explore them. They're not the same when you look at them in a different way. Much of science is how do I look at something in a different way, in a new way? What's it going to tell me that I didn't know before? And one of the goals, really, for me of this exhibit is to use West Mexico to answer the question. Yes, these collections still have value. There's a ton of stuff that we don't know yet, but if we do a better job of analysis, we will.
All right. Well, you can see the exhibit at Gilchrist, West Mexico, Ritual and Identity. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Robert Pickering is a professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa and curator for the exhibit West Mexico, Ritual and Identity, which is on display at Gilchrist through November 6th. He'll be lecturing at the museum on Saturday, July 16th. That's 1 week from this Saturday at 2 o'clock at the Gilchrist Auditorium. More details at gilchrist.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.